Matthew 5:1-12 and Mark 8:31-38 was presented by Ron Julian at the 2007 Summer Institute entitled Soren Kierkegaard. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we have a very short time in these little talks to, this is just my opportunity or whoever gives the talk to make a few comments about the passages that we looked at. This is just my perspective, not speaking for anyone other than myself here. And like I say, it's real short, so lots of things that could be talked about. I won't be able to defend my perspective greatly. I'll just try to give you the outlines of what I think is important. The Beatitudes, starting out there, there are a variety of approaches that people take to the Beatitudes. What sort of a set of messages do we have here? Sometimes people emphasize the Beatitudes are a way of achieving personal blessing in your life now. Robert Schuller wrote a book called The Be Happy Attitudes, and that was his perspective, that the Beatitudes are the way, if you will embrace these qualities, you will be happy in your life today. Sometimes people see it as an emphasis on social justice, on the way we should be living in society together, if we would all stop making war and hating people and instead be peacemakers and so forth, the world would be a better place. I think both of those approaches are missing the central teaching of the Beatitudes. And what I want to try to do is kind of zero in on what I think is happening in the Beatitudes in this way. I want to ask a series of questions, take a series of points, and say, okay, I'm going to decide on this side instead of this side. And by doing this, we will say, all right, it's somewhere over here, it's somewhere over here, it's somewhere over here, and we're going to kind of narrow our way in until we get a general idea of what is it that Jesus is doing. Part of the reason I'm doing it this way is because I want to show you the kinds of decisions that we have to make. And if at any one of these points you would decide differently than the way I'm deciding, then it would lead you to a different conclusion. So, first of all, the question, what does Jesus mean by blessed? I understand the basic idea to be something like fortunate, one who is to be envied, the one you want to be. There's the person who's blessed, and that is the person who either has received or stands to receive the blessing of God. That's the person you want to be. So each beatitude is basically answering the question, who is the lucky one? Who's the one to be envied? Who is the one that you should want to be? Because I want to be among the blessed. So the Beatitudes are saying, these are the ones that you want to be in their number because these are the ones that are fortunate. Secondly, we notice in the Beatitudes, I'm sure you talked about this in your discussion, that it is surprising and paradoxical who it is that Jesus calls blessed. We have the poor, mourning, hungering, persecuted people are fortunate. This is a crucial part of what the Beatitudes are doing, I think. Jesus is implying, I know you think that you know who the lucky ones are. You have an idea who you would want to be in their number, and that would make you lucky, but I'm telling you, you got the wrong idea. There's something else here. Third, each Beatitude gives a reason why that unlikely person is in fact fortunate. Blessed is X because of Y. So it's like, I was fortunate that I had a flat tire because that's how I met my wife. Or Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that he was blessed to be sent to the prison camp because that's where he learned wisdom. This idea that there is something that seems like it's not so great, but in fact you are fortunate to have that because there is this good thing that goes along with that. So, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It is theirs is the kingdom of heaven that is the reason why those who are poor in spirit are fortunate. Okay, now, we have this picture. Blessed is X because of Y. And we want to talk about each side of those things. Let's talk about Y, first of all. I mean, X, Y, Z, Y. The reason that they are lucky. The reasons that these are the lucky ones, I would argue, and this is an important decision, and I'm parting company with some people on this question. The reasons that these are the lucky ones has to do with their future destiny. That's how I would understand the argument here. So theirs is the kingdom of heaven. He really is saying that there is, in the future, the eternal kingdom of God ruled over by the Messiah of God, and the one who enters into that kingdom, that finds life in that kingdom, that would be a great and a wonderful thing to have happen. Well, that is the reason why this one is blessed, because they stand to enter into this kingdom. And each of the reasons given, I would understand in the same way. Inheriting the earth, the comfort that is going to come, seeing God, and so forth. So, the kingdom of heaven, that is when God's rule is established without opposition over the entire world. Inherit the earth, that is when the people of God enter into their inheritance of life in the eternal kingdom of God in the new heavens and new earth. I would understand that. Hunger and thirst for righteousness will be satisfied. That is when Jesus returns and destroys all sin, including the sin in us, so that we will see righteousness in ourselves and in the world around us, and so on. All of them, I think, are talking about how great it would be to enter into that promise of God in the future. That's what makes a person blessed, if they have that inheritance. Okay. Then we come to the other side of it. What are these qualities? What is it? What is X that makes you blessed? I would say about those qualities that it's crucial in understanding them to see two things about those qualities. First of all, they are cryptic and they are necessary. And let me explain what I mean by both of those things. First of all, by cryptic, what I mean is we have to stop and think about them. There's more going on to these qualities than it might sound like at first. And I'll explain that here in a second. And what do I mean by necessary? Jesus is not saying, if you happen to be poor in spirit, don't worry, things will get better in the kingdom of God. He is saying, you must be poor in spirit. It is the poor in spirit who will find a life in the kingdom of God. And if you are not poor in spirit, you will not find a life in the kingdom of God. And both of these are controversial claims, but I want you to be clear to you what it is I'm saying here. Let me illustrate by looking at a couple of things here. First of all, the part about it being cryptic. We can compare in Luke's account of the Beatitudes. In Luke, Jesus says, blessed are the poor and blessed are the hungry. One possibility is, when we read that in Luke, is that he just meant that literally, that the kingdom of God belongs to those who are destitute and can't feed their families. If you are destitute and can't feed your family, the kingdom of God is yours, otherwise it won't be. But I think there are pretty strong reasons to think that that is not what Jesus is saying, although some would claim that it is. But notice how in Matthew, we have blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. In Matthew, we have the figure of being poor or being hungry, which in Luke we might think, well, what does he mean by those things? Does he mean literally poor, or is there something else that he's getting at? In Matthew, Matthew has made explicit that there is a different picture behind that, that he has not literal poverty, but a poverty of spirit, whatever that might mean. Not literal hunger, but a hunger for righteousness. So that shows us that it's quite likely that these images are meant to be kind of pregnant with meaning that might not immediately be apparent. Now, when it comes to the idea of these qualities being necessary, again, Luke's version of the Beatitudes is helpful to us. Because in Luke, we not only have blessings, but we have a curse pronounced as well on the other side. Woe to you who are rich, for you are receiving your comfort in full. Woe to you who laugh now, instead of those who mourn. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets. So we have this alternative. You can be poor or rich, poor in spirit or rich, I would argue. You can be hungry for righteousness, or you can be satisfied now. You can be you can be mourning now, or you can be laughing now. You can be persecuted now, or you can have everybody speaking well of you now. And in each case, you're blessed if you're on this side. Woe to you if you're on this side. So this is not just Jesus just saying, don't worry, if you're unhappy now, things will get better. He is saying, you are going to fall into either the camp that mourns or the camp that laughs. And you don't want to be among those who laugh. You want to be among those who mourn. So that's what I mean by the necessity of these qualities. Now, I would argue very much that this is, in fact, what Jesus is doing. But now this brings us to a place where we have some thinking to do. I mean, what does he mean by this? It's necessary to mourn, for example. What does he mean by that? Laughing is bad, mourning is good. Why? What is it? Why is it woe to me if I laugh? So this brings me to my final point then, that this is how I think we can understand the thrust of what he's saying, and each of the statements deserves a lot of comment, but just in general, I would say that each of these qualities, when properly understood, is an implication and result of being a person of faith. That in essence, what he is saying, if we were to back up and look at the whole thing, is blessed is the one who has put his faith in me, because he stands to inherit the kingdom of God. Now, that might sound like a broad statement. Could he really mean that by all of that? But I think that's the general idea. Let me show you. Let's take, for example, mourning. Those who mourn now will be comforted in the kingdom of God. Those who laugh now will be weeping one day. This is a classic biblical concept, the inversion. Now, there are those who are laughing and those who are mourning. But there is a reversal coming. The ones who are laughing now will be weeping, and the ones who are mourning now will be comforted, will be laughing, in other words. Very often, that kind of inversion is talked about. Jesus does that all the time. James does that all the time. In fact, I think James has a saying that helps us to see the sort of thing that Jesus is getting at here. He is not saying, hey, your entire family was wiped out by a tornado and you're sobbing with grief. Boy, are you lucky. I don't think that's what he's getting at. It's not just happening to be mourning about something. I think the thing that he's getting at, we can see in James, where James says, cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. Now, first of all, I think James is very influenced by Jesus' teaching, especially what we see in Matthew. And I think James' language here about let your laughter be turned into mourning and all of that, I think is influenced by the very thing that we're looking at here in the Beatitudes. But what James is picturing is here are people who are rebels and enemies of God. They call themselves believers, but they are firmly attached to the things of this world. They are fighting and killing and jockeying for power and all of this stuff. And he's saying to them, your laughter should be turned to mourning. You're so happy that you managed to slip the knife into that guy's back and got in and got the position instead of him. You know, you're delighted that you are having this success in the world, but you should be mourning. You should stop laughing and be mourning. I think that's what Jesus is getting at, that fundamentally in this life, either I recognize, along with being poor in spirit, that I am not a success, that I am not pulling it off, that God has no reason to look at me and say, whoa, boy, great job. That if I were to be honest about where I am a person of failure and loss, and I ought to be mourning. And it's the person who is honest about that failure and loss that will in the end be comforted, in the end will receive and not be a person of failure and loss. So that's, I think, the kind of thing that Jesus is talking about. He talks about the one who is persecuted because of Jesus will enter into the kingdom of God, but the one that everyone speaks well of now will get nothing. Again, we see how that could very much be related to what it means to be a person of faith. Jesus is going in a different direction than the rest of the world. I can still remember many years ago, and I'm wondering, is there anybody here? probably not at this point, but there might be. I'm a little vague on this, but I knew a group of folks. They were in a church together, and there was a guy I knew that went and visited it one time, and he came away saying, I wouldn't want to be involved with a group like that. They're a bunch of losers. And he was kind of right. I mean, this is where I want to be careful. There might be somebody here who was in that church. Actually, I think there is. Not everyone who was in the church was a loser, of course. Some of them were really, really winners. But it's just, it's that thing that ultimately, if we come to identify ourselves with what Jesus is really about, that we are going to end up looking and sounding like and being committed to things that the rest of the world is going to look at and say, that's not what I want. They may hate us. They may be indifferent to us. Or they may just think we're losers. I mean, why would you want to be that? I mean, why would you want to be in this group of people? I mean, what's the deal with this? Well, it is when I face into that and recognize for me to follow Jesus may actually cost me something in this world. I may actually lose the respect of people who have the possibility of making my life either good or bad, depending on how they respond to me, up in fact to the point of even killing me in some situations. It's then when I'm having to decide, so do I really want to follow this Jesus? Is this really what I'm looking for? So I think ultimately, what Jesus is getting at here is he's focusing on what we might call the issue of worldliness. That in this world, I have learned what I think is going to make me happy and successful. And the world around me is ready to join me in that. You live a certain way, you accomplish certain things, you have certain things, you do certain things, And you're among those that the people of the world will hold up and say, yes, you're one of us, good job, you know, things are great. But in fact, the qualities that characterize the person who has come to believe in the gospel, who has made that existential commitment that Kierkegaard is talking about, is going to lead you to things that don't seem to be so desirable. Rather than seeing myself as a success and hot stuff, I recognize my real poverty and I mourn over my position in life. But I'm doing that because I'm seeing reality, and in the end, it is those people who will be satisfied and find life. I am merciful. I recognize that I need God's mercy and I need to be merciful to others. People who are merciful are losers. That means you're not getting your stuff back. You're not getting justice. You're not getting vengeance. You're not getting repaid or whatever it might be. But in the end, the person who recognizes I am deeply in need of mercy and so I am going to be merciful to you as well, that's the person who's really the winner. Because that is the person who will receive God's mercy in the end. So, that's what I think the Beatitudes are all about. They're calling us to recognize that the really fortunate person is the one who has existentially embraced the faith such that attitudes and situation in life that might seem to be difficult and not even desirable have come about that will, in the end, lead to true life. And I think, I am no expert on Kierkegaard. You need to talk to others around here to find people who will speak with more confidence to what it is that he has to say. But I think this is related to the concept of the absurd that Kierkegaard is talking about. I think, at least in part, his idea of the absurd relates to this in the world, by the standards which I judge from history and what happens around me, you would not want to be these sort of people. But in the light of who God is and what he has promised and what ultimately is going to be the outcome that God's going to come about, bring about, then these are the people that you want to be. This is where you want to be, because in the end, these are the ones who are blessed. Now, really, really briefly, don't have much time to talk about the other passage. We kind of have two halves to it. We're talking here about Peter's rebuke of Jesus and Jesus' rebuke of Peter, followed by the little teaching that comes after it. What I would understand to be happening in the first part is that Jesus is being chewed out by Peter for saying that he is going to be killed by the Jewish leaders. Peter has just said, "You're the Messiah. Look, you're God's chosen one. I just said so a minute ago. That is not what you should expect. You are going to be victorious. God blesses. You are his favorite. You are his chosen one. And God blesses his favorites." I mean, that's how you can tell you're God's favorite, right? He blesses you. So you're not going to die. You're going to live. You're going to be victorious, and I'm going to go with you. Okay. So, but I think that Jesus sees in Peter's statement not just a misunderstanding, and we were talking about this in our group, but an actual personal temptation for himself, because the picture that's being spelled out for Jesus is a very attractive one. You are God's chosen one. God's going to bless you. You're not going to have to go through this death and cross stuff. And so that's why he says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." That is, that Peter really, innocently enough, but represents a real temptation for Jesus. This picture that somehow God would not ask his favorites to go through death and loss and suffering is exactly wrong. God has in mind to save the world through the death and suffering of Christ. And so Peter is just putting himself in the way of the path that God has called Jesus to take. Then the connection is, I think, that Jesus calls the multitude in and basically teaches them that we all have to face that same sort of decision. I'm not going to die on the cross for the sins of the world. But the fact is, I'm following a guy who died on the cross for the sins of the world, and the world may not be that happy with me either. If I follow him, I may face the same sort of rejection that he does. And let me go backwards through what he says. He ends by saying, if you are ashamed of me and my words, now I will be ashamed of you when I come back. And the idea of this shame here, it's connected with what we saw before, that Jesus is going to be killed and rejected by the important people of this world. Look at what Peter faced. Hey, you're with him, aren't you? No, I don't know him. I mean, he's ashamed. At that moment, he doesn't want to be associated with him because I may face the same sort of rejection that he faced. But Jesus is calling them to embrace that willingly. Follow me anyway. Because my approval in the end, for me to say when I come back, I am not ashamed of you, is more important to you than not being rejected by the world now. To have the world say, we don't like you, and have Jesus say, I do, is the way that you want this to turn out. So, then he uses the language about not losing your life, gaining your life. Again, the issue is if you think that you're going to grab a hold and keep what you've got in this world, in the end, you're going to lose it. And if you think that somehow by not following me or not associating yourself with me that you can keep the world happy with you, so what? That's not going to get you anywhere. It is the person who is willing for my sake to let go of this world who in the end will find life. If you cling to your life so much that you don't want to follow me, then you're going to lose your life. But if you're willing to follow me and let go of the things of this life, then you will find life. In fact, think about the deal here ultimately. You could gain the whole world, but if you were to lose your soul in the process, that's not a good bargain. All of this, I think, is connected to the idea of that we've seen from the beginning of the fact that Jesus is going to be rejected by the world and he's facing death. And now he's saying to those who would follow him, you need to join me in this. You're not going to gain anything by keeping your life if you lose your soul in the process. Grabbing a hold of what you've got now is not going to get you anywhere. And in the end, it is being willing to associate yourself with me and not being ashamed of me that is going to bring you life. I'll just make a last comment on carry your cross. We had some discussion about this in class. The way I understand this is different than the way you often hear this discussed, and maybe I'm not right about this, but in this context, he's just got done talking about how he is going to be killed, executed by the Jews. The cross is an instrument of execution. As I like to say, the cross is like the electric chair is to us. I mean, we have this association. I guess what I'm saying is you don't commit suicide with an electric chair. An electric chair is an instrument of execution. Someone arrests you and says, we're going to kill you, and they put you in an electric chair. So when he says, carry your cross, what I see him as picturing is our willingness to follow him into death. That is, I am not going to cling to this life. I am going to follow the one who has just told me that he is going to be rejected by the world, and I'm going to follow him into that rejection. That's how I understand what that's saying. Perhaps that's not right, but that's what makes sense to me the most at this point. So once again, we have, I think, what Kierkegaard would picture as the absurd. Stick with me, the one who is going to be killed and rejected by the world. If you follow me, you will be rejected by the world as well. But the reason you want to do this is the world in the end is going to lose this fight, and I am going to win. Jesus is going to win. In fact, my death is the very weapon of that victory. So that is why, absurdly, we will follow the one who is going to die and may lead us to the same death, because that's where the real victory will be found. Okay, so that's, we're done. We can, if you have any questions about any of that, we can talk about that in the question and answer. But now it's time for lunch. Thank you.